This is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour again. And tonight I'm going to have a guest. You know, it's funny that on all the shows I've been doing now since we started in October, we've never had anyone call in. And I always was sitting here wondering, is anybody out there listening? Well, I had an example that the people are listening, because when I did the UFO conference 2 weeks ago, there was a couple that drove all the way from New York. They said just to meet me, because they have been listening to the shows. So that makes me feel really good that there are people out there who are listening to the shows, and they say they are downloading the archives and playing them in their cars. And I do get lots of emails, too, from all over the world that people are listening. Otherwise, I sit here in this room and feel I talk to the wall. So that makes me feel good anyway. All right, well, tonight I have a very special guest. It's Dr. O.T. Bonnet. And we are publishing his books with my company. As you probably know, I have the Ozark Mountain Publishing Company. And he's one of the authors that we've been publishing. And we have one book in print, Reincarnation, The View from Eternity. And then we have two more that are just now going to press. One of them is coming off of the press in another week, and then the other one should be off in a few more weeks. So we're having a lot of association with Dr. Bonnet. The two books that are coming off the press now are What I Learned in Medical School and Why Healing Happens. So this is a medical doctor, but he's not your normal medical doctor. So, O.T., I would like it if you could give them your background.
Okay, Dolores.
All right.
Well, I grew up in Wyoming and Kansas and Illinois, and graduated from medical school in 1948 at the University of Illinois. And started a surgical residency, and that was interrupted after 2 years by the Korean War, and I was called into active duty. And after I served my 2 years, I entered general practice in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and practiced there for 18 years. And then joined an HMO in eastern Ohio. We were in the town of Bel Air, Ohio, which is just across the river from Wheeling, West Virginia. And I practiced there for almost 18 years. And during that time, I was on the peer review committees, and I was chief of the Department of Adult Medicine and so forth. Then in 1987, I left that clinic and came out to New Mexico and had a position as the medical director of Miners Colfax Medical Center in Raton. And after 5 years, I retired from that and sat down and taught myself to type and began writing books. And the first book, entitled What I Learned After Medical School, was actually conceived when I first started practice in Illinois. And I started writing it and realized that I really didn't have enough experience to write it in the manner in which I felt the subject deserved. So I put it off and finally accomplished it. And it was originally published in 1994. And that's about it.
Okay. But I know the original publisher, you said, really didn't do very much with it.
No, as a matter of fact, he really made no attempt to market the book at all. And he also wanted to censor what I was writing. And so we've gone through I went through these books and took out a lot of the extraneous remarks that he added, and he changed the tone of the book considerably.
Yes, he did agree with your metaphysical approach to medicine.
No, he didn't. He was, he had a lot of problems with that. I sometimes wondered why he even agreed to publish the books in the first place.
Well, that was one of the reasons, and we got the rights back, and we decided to reprint them. And they really, I think, are very good now because they do go along with your beliefs on how, I guess we would say you're heading more toward the alternative. But you did say all through your medical career you were not like the regular physician. You always had ideas that the other doctors didn't agree with. Isn't that true?
Well, that's true. I always wondered why the medical profession took the stance that it did of spending all that effort and money trying to stamp out disease rather than spending an equal amount figuring out why people got sick in the first place.
Yes.
And I was never satisfied with the explanations that were given in medical school. I always felt that there had to be a deeper meaning and a deeper reason, which finally evolved in my thinking through my years of practice.
Well, that goes along with my work, too, is because I always believe, you know, the people make themselves sick.
Sure they do.
And if they make themselves sick, then they can heal themselves, too.
Exactly.
But, you know, the majority of the people, especially those listening out there, would say, what do you mean? I don't want to be sick. I didn't create the disease. But, you know, in my work, we try to find out why they have it, and we trace it back to past lives. But you said you've also encountered that, too, in your work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I learned to hypnotize people about 1953, I believe. It was probably 53. And I learned from an old stage hypnotist by the name of Dave Ellman. I'm sure you know of him. And
remember him, but there might be people out there who do. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, he was an old stage hypnotist, and he had a lot of friends who were doctors. And in those years, learning hypnosis was considered to be a little bit unethical.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And his doctor friend finally convinced him to teach them what he knew. So he finally began going around the country, and he'd have a group of seven cities, all in driving distance, and he'd go from one city and teach lesson number one, drive to the next city and teach lesson number one in that city, and so forth. And then he'd make the circle and start teaching lesson number two. So he was an excellent teacher. I took one of my patients who happened to be a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois and whose PhD was based on some studies he'd done under hypnosis. And I took him to one of his lectures, and later I asked him what he thought, and he said, "Oh, gee, that old man doesn't know the first thing about the theories of hypnosis." But he says he's the best clinical hypnotist I ever saw in my life. So he says, get in there and learn everything you can. And then he said, but who knows? Maybe what he's saying is true and what we're saying isn't true. He says, it doesn't matter.
That's what I'm finding out because, you know, I'm teaching doctors and psychiatrists all over the world, and they say it doesn't matter if they believe in past lives or not. If it's helping the person, that's the main thing.
That's right. Right.
But whenever you were doing that, you were not taught past life regression, were you?
Well, no. As a matter of fact, the book In Search of Bridie Murphy came out while we were taking the course.
Yeah.
And we asked Dave about it.
That came out about the same time I was getting into all of this, too.
Yeah, well, he just had a conniption and just ranted and raved of wasn't anything so ridiculous as other lives, and he went on and on and on. And I think now that he knew all about it. He just didn't want to get embroiled in that that question.
Yeah, because, you know, that's when I started out, too. There was nothing to show anybody how to do this.
No, not at all.
We had to more or less make our rules as we went along.
Well, I stumbled into it by myself.
That's what I did.
I had a patient who was an excellent subject, and we'd done a lot of medical stuff. And one day she came in close to closing time, and I said, Norma, do you mind if I hypnotize you and ask you a real dumb question? She said, no. So we had a cue, and I hypnotized her and said, did you ever live before you were Norma so-and-so? And she said, oh, yeah. And so she came up with a kind of a story that no one would think to manufacture.
Uh-huh.
And she was a little girl dying in the rubble heap of her home at the time of a war in Middle Europe.
Uh-huh.
And you don't invent stuff like that. If she'd said she was the Queen of Sheba, it would have been a little bit questionable.
That's what I say in my work. They're usually very ordinary lives.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, never be, I said, if they were going to make something up, they would be Cinderella at the ball or the knight in shining armor.
Right.
And that never happens.
Right. And then I learned, or you hear, that people will accept any suggestion under hypnosis. So therefore, hypnosis is not a valid method or means of exploring and getting information. And my experience is that it's just the opposite. People are very correct. They refuse to accept things that aren't true.
Yeah.
And they make no bones about it.
Yeah, that's what I've discovered. They are very accurate, and they go out of their way to be accurate.
Yes. Yes, I had one man who was convinced that his mother had never loved him. So I hypnotized him and took him back to his birth. When he recalled being born, he said, my mother doesn't love me because she won't even hold me. And I said, oh, all mothers love their babies. You just don't understand. She must be upset by some other reason. And he said, doctor, I understand what you're trying to do. But he said, she didn't love me.
Uh-huh.
So I said, okay, I agree.
But you have found the cause of some of the illnesses in your patients went back to past lives.
Oh, yeah, that's very common.
Of course, the other doctors didn't agree with you.
No, they don't understand it. Medical doctors really are very poorly educated. A psychiatrist by the name of William Philpott wrote an essay on this. He said doctors are really poorly educated, slow learners, because they're brainwashed in medical school into believing certain things, and they don't have any experience other than relating to other medical students and doctors. So things that arise out beyond their field of vision is mistrusted and tends to be rejected out of hand. So it's very difficult for doctors to learn things. You go to a meeting or a conference, and you really, all you hear are things that you already know. And the new information is so marginal, and it has to be tied in to what is already accepted, that you don't hear new stuff.
Uh-huh.
So the doctor walks away from the medical meeting feeling very secure that he knows that he's up to date. I heard Linus Pauling, who's a Nobel laureate, talk about the fact that he'd had a number of articles that he was unable to get published in medical journals. The reason was that they were controversial. And he was on a panel with three editors of medical journals. And they said, well, we wouldn't have printed your stuff either, Dr. Pauling, because, he said, it just isn't accepted. And they all agreed that the average doctor didn't have the wherewithal to read new material and decide for themselves whether it was valid or not. Mm-hmm. That the doctor wants to pick up a journal, read it, and feel secure in what he knows. So it's very difficult to get new information into medical literature.
Yeah, because I can understand that. They feel safe, and if they're venturing out into something they don't know, they feel they're taking a chance.
Well, yeah, but that's true. I agree. And the minute they admit that something in their block of knowledge is incorrect, it throws them into a panic, because if they admit that, then there's the possibility that other things that they've been taught really aren't correct.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to hang on to this belief. They stonewall it and suppress it.
Yes, but I'm working now with a lot of doctors who, there are some of my clients who want to switch over to alternative healing, and I'm also working with doctors in Russia on this. And, you know, I see that this is the way it's going. But your average doctor, it's the same way, isn't it? They won't accept the possibility of the natural cures and the herbs. It's as radical as hypnosis is.
Right, right. Well, one of the examples I used in one of my books was a friend who came to me with a sore heel. And he'd injured it about a year and a half before, standing on a ladder painting his living room. And his shoes didn't have real firm soles, so the arch of his foot was bruised. Well, it didn't heal, and it got progressively worse, and his doctor tried all the standard stuff with antiprostaglandins and cortisone injections and heel cups, and nothing helped. The guy was getting worse and worse. He had to walk with a cane. He was a young man. So he finally got sent to an orthopedic surgeon who took an x-ray, and he said, oh, well, you've got calcium in these tendons and a heel spur, and that's what's causing your pain, and we need to do surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the guy didn't have health insurance, and he was in the process of trying to save enough money to get the surgery, and he called me, and he said, OT, is there something you can do to ease the pain? And I said, why do you want surgery? He said, well, I don't want surgery, but it's the only thing that's going to help. And I said, I'm sorry, the heel spur and the calcium are not causing the pain.
Uh-huh.
I said, Mother Nature has a tendency to calcify tendons when they're chronically injured. So I convinced him to come to my house, and he hobbled in a couple of weeks later. And I looked at him, and I said, he had some bruises on his arms and legs. And I said, how much do your gums bleed when you brush your teeth? He said, well, quite a bit. But he said, what's that have to do with my foot? And I said, I think you've got scurvy.
Mm.
I said, do you take vitamins? Well, I used to, but my doctor told me that it was foolish to waste my money with vitamins when I was eating well. And I said, well, you don't really get all the vitamins you need in your food. It's destroyed by cooking and storage and so forth. So I told him to get on some vitamin C. In the meantime, I took him in and hypnotized him. And when he was in a good trance, I said, tell me, did you ever hurt your foot before? And he thought a minute, and he said, oh, yeah, 3, maybe 4 lives ago. He says, I was a stone cutter, and I was working in a quarry. And he said, a huge slab of stone fell over and crushed my foot.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it took him an hour or two to get this huge slab pried loose. And he said, I hobbled around the rest of my life like a crippled old man. He grinned. He said, just like I am now.
Uh-huh.
So I explained to him that this was a different foot. It hadn't been crushed, that it had had plenty of time to heal from this minimal injury of standing on the ladder. And I told him to talk to the cells in his foot and be sure to use the pronouns we and us and our.
Uh-huh.
And he said, why? I said, well, we say a lot of things that we don't really want our body to do. I said, for instance, you say once in a while, oh, God, I wish I were dead.
Uh-huh.
And you really don't want your heart to stop.
Yeah, the body believes everything you say.
We and us and our, the cells don't think they're being included in the conversation.
Uh-huh.
So I said, call me in a couple weeks. Well, he called me in about a month. And I said, well, how are you doing? He said, well, my gums have stopped bleeding. And I said, how's your foot? He said, well, it's no better. I said, have you been talking to it, saying we and us? Well, he sort of hummed and hawed. Well, about a week later, he called me, and he said, you know, I didn't talk to my foot at all, much less like you told me to do. And he said, I got to thinking about it after our last conversation. And he said, I thought, you've never told me something that wasn't so. So he said, that night before I went, while I was going to sleep, I talked to my foot just like you told me to do. So the next morning, I got up, went to the bathroom, got back to bed, and realized my foot didn't hurt at all. And he said, the soreness is gone. Everything's perfect. So I said, well, good way to learn. He said, well, I'm sorry I didn't trust you. I said, that's all right. You were the guy with the pain.
But you know, that happened just a few weeks ago. One of my clients was telling me that she believed, you know, that the cells were alive and you could communicate with the cells. And she was, you know, using that method and something that was wrong with her. But when she told the doctors about it, that she was talking to the cells and that they were, you know, wanting them to heal, you know, the same thing you're talking about, they ended up putting her in a psychiatric hospital.
Oh, you're kidding.
Because they said, you have to be insane to think something like that.
Oh, my God. I thought at least, they or the most, they just laugh at her.
Yeah, because I told her that here I'm publishing a book by a doctor who is believes just what you're saying. And she said, well, then I'm not crazy. And I said, definitely you're not.
What people and doctors don't understand is that cells are discrete living entities.
Yeah.
And they have all sorts of choices to make. Let's digress just a minute.
Okay.
What people don't understand is that the entire universe is made up of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the consciousness consists of discrete units of consciousness.
See, I believe this because this is what I have discovered. But
right. They don't take up space.
Yeah.
And they don't have any mass, but they have certain qualities that really make them alive.
Uh-huh.
And these qualities are, yes, they are in fact conscious. They are aware, which is a little different than being conscious.
Okay.
They communicate. They have memory. They have purpose. They're infinitely creative. And they're precognitive. So, and they cells dream of their future. They know where they are. They know what they're supposed to do. And they know how to heal themselves and to remain healthy.
Yeah.
Providing we don't screw it up with a lot of silly ideas and bad habits.
Well, also you said in the book that they cooperate with us. So if we want to make ourselves sick, they will do it because they think this is what they're supposed to do.
That's right. That's right.
Explain that to people.
Well,
it's
just what you said. The universe is designed so that less vaster entities are to cooperate with vaster entities.
Okay.
Now, this isn't to say that they must, because free will reigns throughout the universe at every level. But if you talk to your cells listen. Now, a perfect example is that I have a friend who had learned to develop a heat shield. And I have actually seen him dip his hand into a pot of boiling water and remove the spaghetti.
Oh.
And he didn't get burned.
Hmm.
And he literally talked to his hand. So when I found out he could do that,
people listening, though.
Yeah, I decided if he could do it, I could do it. So I do all the cooking since we moved to New Mexico.
Okay.
And like everybody else, you get burned from time to time.
Yeah.
So each time I got burned, I'd grab my hand and look at it very intently and say, "We're okay." And it only took about 3 or 4 episodes for it to work. And the burned area doesn't even get red. The pain goes away within a split second. And there just isn't any burn.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that doubts this, all they have to do is to try it.
Well, we wouldn't recommend that they deliberately hurt themselves.
Oh, no, but, you know, every time something like that happens, well, I talked to you. The other day I smashed my thumb with a hammer.
Uh-huh.
It's a product of having trifocals. So you have several nail heads to choose. Anyway, I immediately grabbed my hand and said, "We're okay." And the pain went away.
Okay.
But I do have to admit that the thumbnail was damaged, but it wasn't tender.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I think a lot of people don't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, don't they say that we have a completely new body every 28 days?
Well, we have a that's not quite right.
Because of the cells are constantly replacing themselves.
They say that we have a new body down to the last atom every 7 years.
7 years, but they say because it's constantly replacing itself, isn't it every so many months or so?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
For instance, your heart muscle, half of it is replaced every 2 weeks.
Okay.
And millions of red blood cells are destroyed every minute.
Yeah.
And the same number are regenerated. So the repair of the body goes on at a breakneck pace, and of course we're unaware of it.
This is why we can heal ourselves and make ourselves sick, because the cells are constantly replacing themselves.
Right. Right, yeah, if you constantly think that there's something wrong with your liver, eventually your liver is going to change its function.
It wants to cooperate.
And something will develop in it, yeah.
Oh. Well, in my work, it's come up. You know, I work a lot with the subconscious, and it tells me a lot of things. It says that even after the physical body dies, that all of the cells don't die at one time.
Oh, no.
That it can take as long as 3 days, that each cell is a living thing and it has a lifespan.
Right.
And it can take as long as 3 days for all of these cells to complete their lifespan and also die.
That's true. And even cells and things like ligaments and tendons live a lot longer than that.
Oh, okay.
Now, to take this further, there isn't any such thing as a completely dead body. Because even after the spirit leaves, the atoms are still alive. Because atoms are made up of these units of consciousness, too. So they will eventually be recycled into another living thing.
Okay. Well, everything is energy.
Yes.
And even down to rocks and plants. Because
right.
In my work, I've had people relive lives where they were rocks and plants and animals.
Yes, of course.
And it's all it's all energy. It's just vibrating at different frequencies.
Yeah, and rocks are alive, too.
Yes, and they vibrate a very slow, dense vibration.
The consciousness in rocks is sort of in a state of suspended animation.
Yeah.
Or in a trance-like state.
Because, you know, well, I think I've had enough shows now that the listeners know I've had some very strange cases. But I had someone who experienced being a rock, and I'm writing about this in my new book, The Different States of Life. And he says being a rock was very slow.
Yes.
The words. But, you know, we didn't have to stay in it very long before he went on and experienced other forms.
Well, I had a friend that recalled an incarnation in which she was in a statue.
A statue, okay.
Yeah, and she identified so closely with the statue that when people would admire the statue, she took it as a personal compliment.
Ah.
So I don't know how long she stayed in the statue,
yeah.
But in this incarnation, she just loved little figurines, and her house was full of bric-a-brac with all sorts of little figures and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it was a carryover from her love of having spent a considerable time in this statue.
Because everything is energy, and I found everything is lessons. It's just to experience different forms.
Hello.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, in my book, The Convoluted Universe, Book 1, I had someone go back to a life as a mechanical being.
Yes.
More or less like a robot that
Hello.
Had been created, and it had feelings, and it was alive.
Yep.
And people told me later they had a lot of trouble understanding that, but it was showing us
Hello.
That anything, you know.
Yeah.
That you don't have to be a human or something like that.
No, the other thing people need to understand is that humans don't necessarily look like us.
Uh-huh.
Anything is technically human if it has a human spirit within it. So a fly or a snake or a robot is technically human if it contains a human spirit.
Yeah, and, well, it depends on what you want to call it, because I've found the spirit just goes from body to body so we can learn the experience and have
can anyone hear me?
To learn the lessons.
Right.
That's why
Hello.
I've had many cases where
phone.
They've been on other planets and in other kinds of bodies we wouldn't consider human at all.
Right.
But it was to learn the lesson of what it was like to be in that body.
I hear somebody trying to say hello. Do you?
Well, I kept hearing some kind of sound like a call forwarding or something.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, I heard some little sound. Well, I don't know if some spirit out there is trying to get on the line. I hope not.
Well, I thought maybe it was somebody using this phone number.
I don't think so. I heard some beeping, but it wasn't like other sounds coming.
Okay.
Let me tell the story, too, right at this point. I think it would be a good point to tell it. The way I met OT is very strange. And, you know, we do so much work like this. We do believe in the other side. We believe that we have guides and guardian angels. And this is not strange to us. And I think most of the people out there who are into metaphysics understand this. Anyway, OT first... called us because he was trying to get his book, second book published, and he said the way he found out about us was that he received our catalog. We do, every year, couple of years, we do a mass mail out to all of our mailing lists when we have new books and we have a new catalog coming out. We have about 10,000 on our mailing list. So he received the catalog, and he called up and was wanting to know if he could send his manuscript to us. Then he said, how did you get my name for the catalog? And I said, well, you must have signed a mailing list, I mean, a notebook. Whenever I do a lecture, I put a notebook out and I have people sign the mailing list. Or the people who have read my books will send mail-in letters. And this is how I accumulate my mailing list. And he said, no, he said, I'd never heard of you and I'd never heard of your company before. I know I never signed anything because I've never been to one of your lectures. So it was kind of strange. And then
Hello.
He said, how did you get my real name? Which made it even stranger.
Hello, Dolores.
Hello?
Hello?
Who is that?
I am calling you. I'm listening to your program.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On my computer.
We don't have people call in. I'm sorry.
Oh, I know. Well, you
heard
said
someone
you
saying hello.
You
You're
said
a first.
You wanted someone to call, so here I am.
You're a first. Okay, go ahead and ask the question. Then I will finish the story.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I didn't
That's
know
okay.
when I
just never had it happen yet, so I didn't know what it was.
Yeah. I've been listening to the doctor that you're talking to.
Yeah.
And first of all, I wanted to say that I use that method on myself a lot already without ever having recognized that this was something that other people had discovered.
You mean the talking to your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely.
And using the terms we?
Yes, to some extent.
Yeah.
But that would maybe be more helpful. But I also have a question. I'm almost 75 years old. In fact, I'm your age, Dolores.
Yes.
I was born the same year you were. And I have a condition in my body called WENS, where does the doctor know what I'm talking about?
I can't hear her, Dolores.
Oh, you can't hear her?
No.
Your connections aren't too good.
Okay, she's asking a question. Or can you hear her at all?
Not now.
Okay,
can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay.
Ask OT the question.
All right. My question to you, doctor, is about WENS. That's spelled W-E-N.
Yeah.
You know what those are.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like little pockets of flesh.
Yeah, I knew what they are.
Yeah.
They're pockets of joint fluid.
Joint fluid?
Yeah.
Well, I have several of them on my knee. I have one in the middle of my right calf, and I think one on my left elbow. What can I do to get rid of those?
That doesn't sound like a WEN. A WEN is a little bubble that comes off of usually a tendon sheath, and it's filled with joint fluid.
Oh, so these are more fleshy, and maybe I've got the wrong name.
Yeah, I think you do.
Yeah.
You maybe are talking about sebaceous cysts.
Pardon?
A cyst.
A sebaceous cyst.
All right. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, the only way I know to get rid of those is to have the doctor cut them out.
You're kidding.
No, it's a minor thing.
Yeah.
Puts a little Novocaine in and peels it out.
But I want to let you know that I haven't read your book, but I may definitely order it. Because what you're talking about is exactly what I've been practicing on myself for years.
That's fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah, because it works.
Of course it does.
And you said you're my age. Are you pretty healthy?
Well, yes, actually. And that is only because I work at it.
That's the thing. That's,
yeah. In fact,
you don't have time to get sick.
Right. In fact,
okay, well, I thank you for calling in.
Okay, well, it was nice to hear your voice. I want you to know also that I have read most all your books.
Okay.
And am rereading some of them. I love the Convoluted Universe books.
All right.
They're wonderful.
And if you listen to the rest of the show, I'm going to be talking about a conference we're putting on.
Okay, I'll be back on listening in just a moment. Thank you very much.
Okay, and thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. So, OT, you were correct. OT?
About what?
That there was somebody trying to talk.
Yeah, well, I heard this weak little voice, and it, I couldn't quite make it out.
Well, I heard tones, and Don always said if there was going to be a call-in, he would make little tones. Some way, but I've never had it happen, so I had to figure out who this was. Okay, but let me finish my story, and then we can go back to the other.
Yeah.
Okay, as I said, OT was wondering how we got his name that we sent his catalog to, and because he had never been anywhere, heard me or anything, and he knew he had not ever put his name on any of our lists. Then he said, how did you get my correct name? And I said, what do you mean? Well, now everybody's going to know this, OT.
That's all right.
But OT's real name is Orville, which he hates. So he said he has never used it. He's always used the initials OT. And he said the only time anyone uses the name Orville is when his guides are trying to communicate with him and get his attention. But on the mailing list in our computer, the way his name was listed was Orville Bonnet. Now, he said he would never have put that name down like that. Now, somebody else was involved with this. You know what we mean by somebody. Somebody from the other side apparently wanted all of us to get together, because it has resulted now in three of O.T.'s books being published.
Yeah.
So the people on the other side do work in strange ways.
Well, if I can add something to this, everything you're saying is true. But I had written about 100 publishers trying to get somebody to publish Reincarnation, The View from Eternity.
Yeah.
And we've gotten nowhere. And so finally I just said to my guide, look, if you want this published, you're going to have to do it, because I don't know what more to do.
Well, apparently the guides know how to use the computer, because they got your name in there.
Yes, they do.
It was very strange. You know, is there time for you to tell the story out of the Reincarnation book of where you were in the operating room and your guides were yelling at you?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good story.
The example of how they use your name.
Well, when I first started practice, I was an associate with another general practitioner for a year. And he did vaginal surgery, which is something I really didn't do. I wasn't comfortable doing that. But at any rate, we operated on a woman to repair her pelvic floor. She was a young woman. Her husband was an attorney, and she'd had 4 children. They were all under the age of 6. And she desperately needed some surgery. So I assisted with the operation. And everything went well. And the afternoon of the surgery, my associate said, call the hospital and see how the lady's doing. And so I called, and the nurse said, well, we wondered when you were going to call. She's been in shock all day. And I said, well, how do we know she's in shock if you don't tell us? So I hung up and told my associate what was going on, and he said, well, go over and get some blood started, and I'll get a hold of the leading gynecologist in town and be there as soon as I can. So I went to the hospital and walked into the room, and the woman was sort of a sickly, ashen gray color. And obviously totally bled out. She had no pulse, no blood pressure. I couldn't even hear her heartbeat, and yet she was conscious. And her husband was there, and I looked. She wasn't bleeding on the outside, so the hemorrhage had to be inside.
Uh-huh.
And so I said to her, I prayed. And I said, God damn it, God, you don't want this woman to die, you're going to have to do something, because we sure as hell can't. And immediately the hair on the back of my neck went up, and I was absolutely filled with elation. I could have been jumping for joy. I knew something exciting was going to happen.
Uh-huh.
And her husband was there, and I said, I promise you she's going to be okay.
Uh-huh.
I said, they're going to get Dr. So-and-so, we're going to open her up and get the bleeder, but she's going to be okay. Well, this guy's a trial attorney. He said to me, I don't know why I should believe you, Dr. Bonnet, but for some reason I do. Well, I called the lab to get blood and found out that they didn't have any of her type. She was O negative, and we had given her 2 units during the surgery, and an OB emergency had come in that afternoon and taken the remaining 2 units. So there was no blood to give her.
Uh-huh.
And there was a horrible weather, the storm and high winds, and the nearest blood was in the blood bank in Peoria, Illinois, which was about 110 miles away, and no way to get there. And this feeling of elation continued, and the other doctors showed up, and they decided to take her in and try to find it. And while we were scrubbing for surgery, somebody walked up behind me, and I turned to see who it was, and there wasn't anybody there. Now, all this time, I'm still covered with goose flesh, and I still have this feeling of something wonderful is going to happen. So we finished scrubbing, and we went into the operating room, and the anesthetist, all he was giving her was oxygen. And this presence took its a position across the operating table from where I was, standing all 5 or 6 feet back. And we opened the belly, and it was just hopeless. There was so much blood spread into the tissues that you couldn't even see normal anatomy. And the surgeon said, I'm sorry, your lady's going to die. He said, there's nothing we can do in this. And so I yelled at the entity again. I said, you haven't done anything. You've got to make this guy look and show him where to look. And immediately he put down the needle holder that he'd started to sew her belly up with and reached over and got a big 10-inch hemostat off the table, reached into all that purple gunk, and out squirted some blood. And he quick put the clamp on, and the anesthetist, who was on the other side of the anesthetic screen, who couldn't see a thing that was going on, said, hey, what did you guys do? And the surgeon said, what do you mean? He said, well, suddenly I've got a normal pulse and blood pressure. And he said, what is it? He said, 120 over 70, and her pulse is a nice, steady 76. He said, I haven't been able to get a blood pressure since she came in the operating room. And with that, the entity left. And the woman left the hospital a week later, perfectly fine.
But did you also say that the entity, it called you by the name Orville, didn't it?
No, that was when he was telling me to quit my residency in surgery and go into general practice.
Oh, okay, because you said that's the only time that you hear that name is with the...
my first call
is Orville. I just trying to get your attention.
Yeah, I was named for my dad, who was a great guy, but I never liked the name. But I was getting ready to return to my residency after my duty with the Korean War. And our family's general, my parents' family doctor had suggested I go into practice with him. And for some reason, I thought I ought to consider it. And so I spent about 2 weeks or 3 weeks praying and going over the decisions, and I couldn't figure out how I was going to make a decision that would affect my entire life. So I put the idea out of my mind, and one afternoon I was home, and I was putting a stack of records on the record changer, and my mind was blank, and at that moment it seemed and felt as if somebody had taken me by the shoulders and was shaking me violently.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember being shaken a couple times when I was a little boy, when you sort of went, rrr, rrr, you know.
Yeah.
And I heard this voice saying, Orville, I want you to go into general practice.
Uh-huh.
And I started shaking, and I shook for a good 20 minutes. And when he got through, I put down he left, and I picked up the phone and called the hospital in Chicago and spoke to the chief of surgery and said, I'm sorry, I won't be able to return.
Okay, well, O.T., I'm going to have to stop because the clock is ticking away here.
Well, that was a fast hour, wasn't it?
Oh, it certainly was, but before we go off, I do want to tell people we are giving our first conference here in Fayetteville, Arkansas. We're calling it the Transformation Conference, and it is June 3rd and 4th of this year, and I am doing it to promote our authors. And O.T. Bonnet, Dr. Bonnet, will be one of our speakers, and he's going to be speaking on both days, Saturday and Sunday, speaking about the one day on what he found out about reincarnation and with past lives and the universe, the one book of reincarnation, The View from Eternity. And on Sunday, he'll also be speaking about his work with medicine that was contrary to the normal medical practices. So I want to tell everyone about the conference, and we're also going to have many other wonderful speakers. But O.T. is going to be speaking on both days, June the 3rd and the 4th. So if anyone wants any information about the conference, contact us at 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-935-0045. 1-800-935-0045. Or look it up on our website. You'll find all the information about the conference. The website is www.OzarkMountain, which is the name of my company, but Ozark Mountain is abbreviated, OzarkMT.com. And you can also find out about the books and how to order them. So let's sign off now until next time when I'll have another wonderful guest. Good night.
Good night.